It's The Wonky Show. It's a special edition this week. We're asking how we maintain our emotional and mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. We process the events of the week just gone. We've got top tips for staying healthy while working or studying at home. And we think about what universities and government should be doing to help. It's all coming up.
Yes, I mean, I suppose at the moment people are working on a day-to-day kind of motivation, and it's quite easy to tick things off a checklist and keep your motivation going that way. But we know from a lot of models of motivation, psychological models of motivation.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Debbie McVitie, and what a week it's been, not just for universities, but for the whole country. New modelling of the spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus in the UK from scientists at Imperial College London has led to a ramping up of restrictions to try to slow the rates of infection and keep people safe. But besides all the practical challenges for university staff and students in coping with the new world order, it's been a really difficult week for all of us, emotionally and mentally. We've had to adjust to new ways of working and studying, updated government guidance every few days, and enormous uncertainty, as we don't know how long all this will last or what the consequences might be. For those of us who are ill or vulnerable or who have loved ones at risk, it's an even greater struggle. So this week's podcast is a special edition, focusing on maintaining our emotional and mental health and well-being during this pandemic and what individuals, organisations and government can do at scale to help. And to help us through that, as usual, we have two amazing guests. In the UUK Spoke in Brixton, we have John Dupuri, Assistant Director of Policy at Universities UK. John, I won't ask for your highlight of the week, but can you give us a reason to be cheerful?
Yes, Debbie, thanks for the introduction and for inviting me on. I think my reason to be cheerful at the moment is the way that people at all levels in institutions are sort of working ferociously and pulling together to respond to the national crisis, and already thinking about not just how universities respond for themselves and their populations, but how we can also give to the national effort. I'm really proud of our sector for the work that's already being done to support the NHS, communities and the nation in this.
Thanks, John. And in Queen's Park, London, we have Fran Longstaff, Head of Psychology at FICA. Fran, what's your reason to be cheerful this week?
Yeah, I think my reason to be cheerful is, you know, just observing the way that colleagues at different universities are, you know, working really hard with this situation, but also the kind of the laughter that they're maintaining through this as well. There's a real kind of bond and coming together there that's really, really nice to see.
So, in the space of a week, most UK universities have moved all their teaching online. Staff and students are self-isolating in some cases, and some have been confirmed as testing positive for COVID-19. Just to recap on the week, on Monday evening, the government updated public health guidance advising social distancing, cancelling non-essential travel and saying that anyone who can work from home should. Then on Thursday, the government announced that schools and nurseries will close and that summer exams will be cancelled. There have been widespread reports of panic buying and stockpiling. Large parts of the economy are in jeopardy and people are really concerned for their families and for their freedoms. John, how's all this felt as we've watched the week unfold?
I mean, I think it's incredibly frightening. And I think that, I think that's a rational response to the pace of change and the depth of the crisis that we're facing. And we're facing it as a nation, as we're told and as we understand, but we're also really facing it as individuals, as families, and of course, as education settings. But the pressures on staff in particular at the moment, as well as students and their parents, are enormous. I think people are pulling 16, 18-hour days. I think it's fierce at the moment. And credit to the people in institutions who are responding in that way.
Well, I think any time there's uncertainty, uncertainty is one of our biggest stressors, you know, sources of stress. And we can definitely feel this. I suppose what we're seeing in universities is they're trying to work within all the things that they don't know. And I think that they're doing a really good job. But there's a lot of fear there about even what the sector might look like in the next 6 months. A lot of fear about what will happen for recruitment in September, October. Yeah, lots of unknowns that's causing a lot of anxiety.
Are there particular groups of students? Indeed staff, because one of the things, of course, is that everyone's going to be impacted in a slightly different way. You know, some people are living in a flat with, you know, lots of housemates, and some people have, you know, homes with gardens, and, you know, some people are doing the sorts of jobs that, you know, really require them to show up and be present, and some people are able to work remotely. So, you know, which groups of students and staff do we think are particularly going to be affected, and in what ways, John?
So I think we could spend a lot of time describing different groups, but clearly we understand that international students were one of the first groups to be affected by the pandemic as it spread out across the world. But equally, estranged students, those with caring responsibilities for the vulnerable categories, and those, of course, are the older, or those with chronic long-term illness involving immunosuppression. I think also clearly there are groups of staff who one might call core staff, and those would obviously be staff who are involved in the support of students and the support of staff, but also core staff who were there keeping some hard-to-close functions open. And those might be laboratories that are needed for the national interest, or they might be laboratories that are difficult to shut down for other reasons. They would also include some of the core staff who are involved in the day-to-day, week-on-week administration of universities, you know, from the leadership teams through to security teams and so on. So I think there are particular pressures on them. But although we can single out particular groups who are being impacted in different ways on this, this really runs across the entire university community. I think we need to recognize that there's that global impact, and then pick off targeted support for those with particular needs.
In terms of, sort of emotional health and well-being, this is a really distinctive situation, isn't it, Fran? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, we often talk about mental health at the individual level, about individuals going through things, you know, perhaps, you know, building to a crisis point. But of course, you know, this is the entire of society perhaps having a kind of a challenging emotional experience all at the same time. You know, how does that work in psychological terms?
Yeah, it's going to be a really tricky time for a lot of people, because if we almost think of it as our psychological nutrients, we're going to be running a little bit lower on some of those kind of things that we really need as people. There's no replacement really for face-to-face human connection. So we know that, you know, people may well struggle with that, and they'll have to find alternatives for that. We know, I mean, you mentioned before about students living in cramped house shares. You know, that's going to bring up its own problems as well. You know, we need our own time as well. That's a core psychological nutrient for us. It's something we really need. It's actually called hyper-core presence when you're living on top of people. It's incredibly stressful, especially given that, you know, there's been surveys where people have been asked, you know, what's your most relaxing pastime? And the overwhelming response was to be able to spend time on your own. So if you're not able to have that, that's going to cause problems. And I think also, you know, other kind of difficulties that we might face is kind of not being able to spend as much time outside in nature. You know, that is one of our biggest psychological nutrients. It's been found to reduce stress, improve mood. So these are all things that people are gonna be coping with over indefinitely the next few months. I guess if I was gonna give any advice, which I tend to try not to do, but being able to control the things that you have control over, that's the only place that you can really start. And the uncertainties, they're almost things that, things like mindfulness and acceptance techniques are actually really useful in those instances, because until you have something that resembles a solid fact, a solid bit of evidence to work with, you can really spiral very quickly into what if thinking, rumination, and that can be really problematic for people.
I think it's really interesting and really thank you, Fran, for suggesting that key element of kind of resting on what you can influence in your individual circumstance. But what's really interesting here as well is that we're getting into uncharted territory, because this is a, as you signaled, a collective challenge around uncertain future. And, you know, there have been other situations around the world in disasters and emergencies where similar collective challenges have been faced and endured. And I think that as well as that individual psychological response, we must be thinking about the collective psychological response as well, and kind of borrowing from the best evidence on that. And I'm really pleased to see that the mental health research community is stepping up and looking at kind of convening evidence and actually indeed conducting research about the best ways to respond collectively as well as individually to this, because I think this will have repercussions across the full spectrum of our mental health, every individual, every family, every community, but it will also involve some severe repercussions for those who are already facing mental health difficulties, and I think we're already starting to see some signs of that in our community as well.
Right. All week on the site, we have had contributions from across the Wonky community on the impact of the COVID-19 coronavirus. So let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Debbie Holly, Professor of Learning Innovation at Bournemouth University and a National Teaching Fellow. My article, Remote Learning Means We Need to Radically Rethink Assessment, is really trying to help us consider the exceptional circumstances we find ourselves in and focusing on our students and their learning experiences. I'm filled with horror as institution after institution's first response is to push learners, both academics and students, online and replacing like with like, you know, making an online huge lecture from a face-to-face lecture, and all of the stresses of moving our practice on. Synchronous learning, real-time learning, is not necessarily the optimal option. Take a student who may be at home with two school-aged children, a noisy dog, no private study space and flaky Wi-Fi. You know, something much more measured, bite-sized would probably meet their learning needs much, much better. My article suggests some straightforward solutions to take off the pressure. By looking at alternative assessments, we can align our teaching, learning and assessment practice in a meaningful way. Indeed, we can do exactly what John Biggs advocated and constructively align our practices.
My name is Simon Horrocks. I'm currently an independent consultant, but I was previously with Edinburgh University and the OU. My piece this week is about the role of university comms teams in responding to COVID-19. Like many parts of universities, these teams are under a lot of pressure right now. And I was interested to look last weekend at how these teams were using social media channels to communicate and engage with their audiences. Some teams did an absolutely fantastic job. And towards the end of the piece, I give some tips about how university teams, comms teams, can use these channels well in these difficult times.
Now, next up, although not everyone can work from home, it's now expected that those who can should. Teaching staff are delivering teaching remotely, and students are learning remotely. Families and groups who are in self-isolation are restricted in their movements. And for many, this change in practice will come as a shock to the system.
Yeah, I mean, this will be a really interesting time for a lot of students, because there are often a lot of external structures in place at universities that really help with motivation. And this will be an interesting time, because it'll be really, really within their control and their ownership now. But simple things to men. Maintain motivation really would be to try and maintain some form of routine. So there's a crazy, it's some wild statistic that something like 80% of young professionals admit to working at home in bed. That's really not a good thing to be doing if you're a student, because it really kind of messes up that association between the bed and what it's for, essentially. Getting dressed is a big thing as well. Setting daily goals, really important. And also setting time to connect with peers. We know from vast amounts of research that peers, you know, course mates, friends from university, often the first point of call, and huge sources of motivation. So setting aside kind of daily times where they can catch up as a group would be really important. we know that if we share our goals with a friend, we're more likely to do them as well. So it can be a useful exercise to start the day where people might share what they're going to be getting done that day. And as well, you know, maintaining some level of physical activity is a, you know, it's a huge factor as well for motivation. So I know lots of universities have acted very quickly and have offered resources. John was telling me earlier that his daughter's PE teacher as well has put together a kind of online resource where she can do kind of dance at home. And I think these things are really important to, in many ways, maintain a sense of momentum. It's a lot easier to keep that boulder moving rather than it stop and have to start trying to really put a lot of effort into moving that. So they would be my recommendations for sure.
And I can definitely share those dance videos if you'd if everyone would like to join in. I had a couple of other points to add to that, and
of course.
And one is that really important point about physical activity, and Fran's quite rightly pointed at the link between physical and mental health. And just to note that Professor Chris Whitty has strongly advised that we keep our physical health going as well during this period. And although it may feel like we have to stay in our houses and flats and accommodation, actually he's encouraging us to get out and get into the parks and still practice the physical distancing of two meters and so on, but to get out and to run or to walk or whatever physical activity seems appropriate. So that's the first thing. I actually really like starting a work from home day with something like a walk to work, which might just be round the block locally, because it does give that break into the work. And the other point, which I'm shamelessly stealing from friends and colleagues at the Wellcome Trust, they've appointed a head of office silliness for this period to kind of suggest stupid games and activities to keep people going and to keep that social interaction going that isn't all about serious stuff. You know, what a fantastic place to work, apart from anything else, as they're demonstrating now. But also what a great idea to kind of keep those other aspects of our work interactions going.
Well, I wonder if kind of students might be rather ahead of the curve on some of this, because, of course, lots of students are very used to taking part in online activity. So, I mean, just looking at some of the things that student unions have been doing this week, we've had virtual pub quizzes, virtual kind of get-togethers. So, there's a lot of that sort of thing going on. I wonder whether, I mean, John, a lot of university staff are perhaps used to kind of self-motivating and working kind of reasonably flexibly. Is there a risk perhaps that, you know, some university staff may not notice the kind of building sense of isolation and they may need to be a bit more proactive about making sure that that sense of connection is maintained?
I think that's a really good point, Debbie. I think, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at in increasing detail, even before the crisis hit, was the question of how to support, in particular, early researchers, early career researchers, and postgraduate research students. We know that a lot of early career research is really done in isolation, and that there are particular stresses and risks associated with that. So I think, you know, I would class PGR students as a group who are, we're encouraging our members really to have a particular focus on during this period. I think they anyway have those risks of isolation, very often kind of long working hours, and a blurring of lines between, you know, commitment to their subject and what constitutes good working practice as well.
I think that's a really, really interesting point there, John, about the blurring of boundaries, because anecdotally I'm hearing from quite a lot of colleagues and friends that because they're working from home, they're actually struggling to switch the laptop off at the end of a working day. So it's not just an issue necessarily with motivation. It can be an issue with taking time for yourself as well, those study breaks that often we would have just purely from the nature of the working day at a university when you're within that structure. So I think that's something to be really mindful of as well.
Yeah, I would really, really agree, Fran. I think, you know, I'd venture to say that anyway, academic cultures are unclear about that distinction. And you know, and it's let's say it's not rare that I will get emails from senior academics, you know, late into the night, sometimes early hours of the morning. So I think, you know, let's, now that we're all doing this and we're all going to be doing it for a period, let's use it to keep an eye on each other and our working practices and perhaps encourage some different approaches to this as we emerge from the tunnel in 6 or 12 months time.
This is what I was going to ask actually, John. So, you know, is there an opportunity here to perhaps reflect on some of our, some of this might be really practical stuff about, you know, perhaps moving more for, you know, away from paper, for example, is it going to be a necessity as we work remotely. But are there kind of positive things that we could learn about how to work efficiently and effectively during this time that we could then bring back when we're all sort of interacting with each other once again?
Absolutely. Yes, Debbie. I think, in my discussions with senior leadership in universities, in our discussions across the UK team, you know, we've had to do a kind of radical prioritization process at pace in the last week or 2 weeks. And you strip out stuff. And as you work on the priorities, you understand that your way of working and the themes that you're working on, you're doing a constant prioritization and recalibration as you're going along at the moment. And I don't doubt that there will be learning from this. I think the question is how to kind of capture it and embed it. And I'm really pleased that, for example, JISC and others are stepping up into this space and, supporting the move to remote working, supporting the digital platforms that are needed for that. There's a similar process going on actually in healthcare at the moment and in the NHS where, you know, quite properly, GPs are moving to telephone or Skype triage. But this has been quite uncharted territory for them as well. And, again, it's great to see senior researchers and Professor Tricia Greenhalgh at Oxford springs to mind, stepping in and supporting them with the best evidence on how to do this, how to diagnose effectively at distance and so on. I don't doubt that there will be similar focus and learning in our sector as well.
Right. At the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, I spoke to Lisa Bayliss-Pratt, Pro Vice-Chancellor at Coventry University and former chief nurse at Health Education England. We talked about coronavirus and university's role in keeping staff and students healthy. I started by asking her how public thinking on mental health has changed in the last 5 years and how mental health has moved from the margins to the mainstream.
Well, I think that mental health has always been an issue. It's just that the profile and the status and the stigma around it, I think, has been very much in a let's not talk about this issue, let's just park it somewhere. Whereas over the last 5 years, I think we've had high-profile figures in all sectors speak up about their own mental health or the mental health of their loved one. And I think that really started a social movement and more curiosity amongst people in communities to think about it in a slightly different way. And as a result, more people are talking about it. Therefore, more people want to know how to manage it. They're accessing services that are trying to catch up with, I think, this change in mindset around mental health. You know, mental health and physical health are connected, and services that do well are those services that look after the whole person and take the person holistically into account when they've got some kind of a health issue. So I think we're on a journey, and I'm really pleased that we are talking about mental health and we aren't keeping it hidden away as some secret that we don't mention very often. And as a result, I think that there's lots of work to do, and we'll learn lots more about what other problems are before we'll get to know what all of the solutions are with this agenda.
That's really interesting when you talk about being, you know, treating the whole person and being conscious of the whole person, because I suppose that trend in public health is actually replicating itself to some extent in education as we think about all the kind of diverse needs that students might have as whole people rather than as sort of learning minds, and so it absolutely translates. One of the things that's happening right now is, you know, we're recording this at what looks to be the beginnings of a really difficult time for public health, because, of course, we're just beginning to kind of consider the implications of the coronavirus pandemic. You know, is there a risk, I suppose, that, you know, a lot of the good work that's going on around health and well-being becomes, will this help that, or will it hinder it?
Well, I think the thing is, with the coronavirus, it's ever more important to think about people's health and well-being and really put the focus on how people are, you know, exercising, how they're eating well, how they're getting plenty of sleep, how they're finding ways to connect, because we know that when people are lonely and when people are not connected and don't feel like they belong, this affects their mental health, which in turn affects their physical health and vice versa. So if anything, I think this is a really wonderful opportunity in a strange way to continue to raise the profile of how do you keep well, how do we build resilience, how do we connect in lots of different ways in order to get through this. So I think there is that real focus, and there's lots of media interest around how do you keep well and how do you keep yourself in a good position so that if you do get the virus, you've got a really good opportunity of recovering from it. So in a way, I think the coronavirus gives us that further emphasis to say, are you eating well? Are you sleeping? Are you getting outside? How are you communicating with your loved ones if indeed they're self-isolating? What mechanisms are you using to keep in touch? And I think when we get to the other side of this, we'll have learned lots of lessons about how to continue to educate our students from a distance, how to use technology in a really meaningful way to keep those connections, and hopefully how people really think about, you know, simple stuff like trying to eat well and washing their hands and finding ways to connect with each other when they can't just see each other face to face because of this situation.
So this approach you're describing, the kind of, I guess, the whole person approach that, I guess, takes account of how people's behaviours and their kind of mental state might affect how they perceive the world and how they engage and experience the world. How are you kind of feeding that into your thinking around health and well-being as you develop your strategy at Coventry?
Yeah, well, I think we are absolutely looking at it as a whole system approach, and we're really, really wanting to make the links between physical health and mental health, prevention, and that whole agenda around how do you look at this in a holistic sort of fashion, really. We really think there are some important pillars that we're currently developing work streams around. So we really recognise that you need to have strong leadership around this agenda, and I'm delighted as a senior leader that I've got the lead for this. I think that shows a commitment from the organisation. We're really keen to explore how we can put in lots of prevention activities, so we start to shift the dial from, you know, treatment to early intervention and prevention. So how do we really build meaningful initiatives and interventions to help people keep as well as they can or live well with an existing condition that they've already come to us with when they come to the university? We're exploring support and looking at different types of support mechanisms, and, you know, there's some really interesting stuff around work-based compassion, and how do you create a compassionate workforce? How do you do lots of little things in an effective way that help keep people feeling as well as they possibly can do? We're really strong on partnerships at this university, and we're really joining up with the people that we work for to make sure that when people, you know, do need to access maybe a mental health service, we've got the right mechanisms in place and people are aware when it is right to move into that space. And working with, I mean, for Coventry University, we've got the City of Culture in 2021. This in Coventry City, there was a year of wellbeing last year led by the council. So there's lots of work that we're doing with them and learning from by being part of that agenda, sharing that with our other campuses in London and Scarborough, and exploring elsewhere how we can utilise the things that we've learned. And then the other area for us is around data and actually understanding what the relationships are between student satisfaction and health and wellbeing interventions, and, you know, trying to understand how people are feeling and whether you can relate that to particular data sets to help us really understand where the challenges are, where the opportunities are, and where actually we're making a real difference. So if we've got particular schools or faculties that are really engaged in this agenda, we're starting to ask the question, so what impact is that having? Can you see the difference that this is making on your students, you know, to really enable them to be as best as they can, to have that cutting edge and to be really driven to be the very best that they possibly can? So those are the sort of areas of activity that we're building the framework around. And I'm delighted to say that, you know, there's lots of energy and enthusiasm, not only within this organisation, but also across the sector, as I know you all know. But I really think we're at that stage now where we're trying to, you know, not just grapple with something that can be quite difficult, but really deeply understand, okay, how do we manage this? What are the best interventions that we can possibly develop? And how can we do this across our whole system and not just have piecemeal activities or respond to people when they're poorly? How do we help people to keep well and recognise when they're not so well that we can put interventions in place to stop them from getting even more sicker?
Now, finally, this week, universities are dealing with numerous practical issues of the pandemic, from modelling the financial implications of a loss of international student income, transitioning teaching and services online, planning for changes to assessments, and safeguarding students on placements, especially those on health courses. But amongst all these practical concerns, there's also a duty of care to the physical and mental well-being of staff and students. And of course, those in charge need to take seriously their own duty of self-care and try to manage the risk of burnout, especially as we don't know how long all of this will carry on for. John, can you give us a peek behind the scenes at Universities UK? How are universities managing these issues, and what are the issues that they're raising with you?
So thank you, Debbie. I mean, this has had a huge impact across everything that we do, just as it's had a huge impact across everything our members do. And our response, which is to understand the impact, immediate, medium term, long term, and then to focus on mitigation of that impact, has really now devolved from an immediate COVID response group into separate work strands. And you could imagine that those would have covered in the first instance international students and implications, financial implications, regulatory and standards impacts, and then also this question that we spoke about already around domestic admissions as well. But key in those five strands is actually really framed as an overarching strand as well, is the question of student and staff welfare and well-being. And I think that has really, in the way that institutions and students and staff have responded to this, and our leadership, has been the priority. It's certainly in my conversations with vice chancellors and senior teams, their first focus is students and staff. And I would say it goes beyond a duty of care, Debbie. I think this is understanding that students and staff are the core of the university, and that their safety, health and well-being is the priority during this crisis.
Fran, one of the work that's been going on in recent years in universities has been to try and shift a sort of crisis response approach to mental health to a much more kind of whole campus preventative, development of healthy emotional resilience and those sorts of habits. Can this work continue in a crisis, and what might that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think students as a whole are becoming a lot more aware of, you know, what are the things that are good for them psychologically, and they're really aware of the things that they need to do in order to maintain good psychological health. And I think that can absolutely continue, because I think it's important to remember in maintaining psychological well-being, just 5 minutes a day of even just reflecting on something that you're grateful for example, is a route to doing that. So it's not that the world of proactive psychological health would stop because of this. There are things that can easily be weaved into a student and staff member's day to maintain that psychological health. And things like, you know, we're looking now with tech, you know, there are online communities that you can join, get involved with. And I think the universities will also respond very quickly with their own provisions as well. Just keep people connected and keep those positive, healthy habits going.
And are there things that universities can do to promote that, I suppose, you know, beyond sort of recommending it to individuals?
I mean, I'm seeing a lot of, it's really heartening, actually. I'm tuned into a lot of universities and their comms teams are, they're in overdrive. You know, they're putting out constantly, why not try this bit of activity or this thing? And it's really good to see they're actively supporting the student body with all the things that are good for them.
It's probably worth me adding, Debbie and Fran, that you know, there's obviously been an announcement this week on supporting core workforce across the UK, and universities have been proactive in this and really thought about you know, as we've moved to remote working and remote learning across many of our institutions. And by the way, thank you very much to Wonky and to David Kay for that amazing mapping exercise that you're doing on that. It's incredibly helpful for us. But as we've made that move, we very much have focused on what core staff do need to be still at work, whether actually on site or at distance. And clearly student support staff and staff support are core staff. There'll be other categories as well. It's worth noting also that we're trying to get at speed a clarification with the Cabinet Office about whether they have included these groups of staff in their wide definition of educational staff, and we'll be pressing for that, because it is quite possible as we go into further lockdown with potential travel restrictions that we will need to show exemption in order to go to work and to do those core functions. So that's the first point. I think there's another question here, which is, does the strategic approach continue? Which is, you know, again, if we think about what Step Change set out and what the Student Minds Mental Health Charter elaborated, which is this whole university approach to mental health / health as an enabler of everything we do. I think, you know, obviously in the crisis response, this first phase, everything else is put aside. But this strategic response, and I'm already hearing from leaders on this, how essential it is being reinforced at the moment. Universities are galvanizing themselves along with the nation to think about safety, health, and well-being. And that's very much the messaging in the whole university approach. So I think both the kind of individual psychological supports that Fran was talking about, the maintaining of core services and support for students and staff, but also the strategic approach, are all continuing through the crisis, as they should.
And there's been some quite good examples this week, hasn't there, of vice chancellors ticking to the airwaves to kind of offer reassurance to staff and show leadership and put that well-being at the kind of centre of how they're thinking right now. John, have you got some sort of good examples you can kind of point us to?
Well, I think there are examples of that, and I'd very much expect our senior leadership to do that. But I can think of, you know, there are many examples where vice chancellors have done, for example, interviews with senior local general practitioners to really kind of bring home some of the key public health advice for students and staff. But actually, where I'm really interested to see this is in the communities that are building across our students and staff. Rosie Tressler from Student Minds has been kind of signalling and supporting some of the work that students and students' unions are doing to really pull together in the face of the crisis to share good public health information and support at the moment. So I think there are lots of examples of that across all parts of the university community.
And is there anything that government needs to do to support those efforts or to kind of give clarity on issues that really could do with being resolved?
Yes, I mean, I think that we're in a very close and very constructive discussion with government, and obviously particularly with the Department for Education, but housing, local government, and communities as well, and the Department for Health. And I think, you know, keeping those close discussions going is the first rule of constructive policy making that doesn't have unintended consequences. And so, for example, I've already signalled that we're working hard on a clarification of what constitutes core workforce from the Cabinet Office. But there are multiple other engagements, as you might imagine, Debbie, around, for example, clarifying rules with the Home Office on immigration. For international students and staff who are unable to go home. That really big and important piece of work on deploying third year health students onto an emergency register so that they can support the NHS at this critical time. You know, this is really significant work, and huge credit to the NHS, to the regulators, and to universities led and mobilised by the Council of Deans of Health to achieve this. But there will be lots of implications to work through with that, both in terms of the safety and proper induction of those students, but also in terms of return to education, how they qualify, how they graduate, and so on. Close working with government is at the core of government are also working at huge pace, and making decisions that respond to the situation as it changes. And we absolutely recognise that, and we're grateful to them for keeping us very close in any discussions about HE and populations in higher education.
Fran, in terms of messaging, do you feel like the approach of politicians has been exemplary best practice in terms of supporting the kind of wellbeing and emotional health of the nation? That's not a loaded question.
well, actually, I think I'm a big fan of Chris Whitty. I think he's done a really good job of keeping that at the forefront of people's minds. So I think I think it's definitely something that on the basis of that messaging that's coming out, people are really aware of it. And then you can see that that's cascading through all of the social media, news, etc. It's really at the forefront now of people's minds to make sure that, hang on, my life has changed, the structure's changed rapidly. What things do I need to do to make sure that I'm psychologically and mentally fit?
I think there's a really interesting role for universities and academics at the moment, which is that we have a wash of fake news as a result. I mean, you know, of all kinds. That includes, for example, phishing attempts based on COVID-19 worries, right the way through to reports of Russian bot factories trying to stir up to destroy social cohesion at the moment. So I think we need to read reports with care, and I think our senior academics need to be part of that. And I was very struck recently by an excellent piece in The Conversation about how to read the science behind the current crisis, and how to distinguish the fake or the tendentious from the real in this. I just also wanted to come in behind what Fran said and say that I think Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance have been exceptional in this, as have the team at Imperial, but a much wider constituency of researchers across many institutions and many disciplines who are focusing on this constructively. And that includes voices in opposition to the main strand of policy, because we do need to keep checking the models. We do need to keep understanding about necessary changes in policy as those come out.
And Fran, so obviously everyone is going to be quite motivated in the first couple of weeks because, you know, we're all having to be really conscious about the changes that we're making in our lifestyles. But are there things that people can do to prepare for the long haul? You know, if these restrictions last for kind of months.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Yes, I mean, I suppose at the moment people are working on a day-to-day kind of motivation, and it's quite easy to tick things off a checklist and keep your motivation going that way. But we know from a lot of models of motivation, psychological models of motivation, that a sense of purpose and really knowing what your values are as a person is really key to keeping any kind of longer term motivation going. So I think at some point it's really important to check in with yourself and say, you know, what are my values as a person? What do I value, and what's my purpose? And make that clear for yourself, because that really will be the fuel that keeps that motivational fire going. If you're looking at months of kind of doing your work on your own, for example. So I think that's a really useful thing to do, to just take stock of what am I about as a person, who do I want to be, what do I want to be, and then that can be really useful fuel. But they're big questions to ask yourself.
They're also questions, aren't they, that really inform how universities are responding.
Absolutely.
Sort of understanding what we're for and who we're for, you know, for our populations, but also for the communities around us. And I think that sense of purpose and mission is what's going to get us through this.
Yeah, and I think it's really nice you say that, because I think the way that the universities have responded is, I think we said before we had this call, it's just testament to the values and the belief systems that underpin universities. It's just really great to see.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. If you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Fran, John, and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay healthy.